And can we have a moment of silence and then have the serenity prayer, please? God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. I have the privilege this morning of doing a workshop on sponsorship. And I want to go back to a conversation that by the timeline had to take place, I believe, sometime in April of 1935. Bill Wilson was sober coming up on 6 months. And he had worked with or attempted to a number of alcoholics in and around New York with no success whatsoever. I was in New York at General Service, and they had a thing in there that said Bill worked with 96 people. I thought to myself, how could they possibly know that, right? But that's what it said. Let's just say for 6 months he worked with a lot of people with no success. So Bill had decided on his own that he would return to Wall Street, get Lois out of that department store, and start making a living. So he came home, and he shared that with Lois, his wife. And this is a conversation that, had it not gone the way it went, I don't know that we would be here. But Bill says, yeah, I think I'm going to go back to work. Nobody's getting helped, and you know, I've given it my best shot. I know Ebby told me to try to work with other people, but nobody's getting it, so, you know, let's just get back to work and move on. And Lois said something to Bill. And later on, when asked about it, she said, well, it was the truth. She said to Bill, yes, it is true. No one that you've worked with has stayed sober. But you have stayed sober. And you haven't stayed sober 6 months since I've known you, right? And I've known you for quite some time, right? So out of that, came for Bill the realization, when we look at chapter 7, working with others, practical experience means tried and proven. It's not theoretical. Practical experience shows that nothing, and I got that circled, nothing will so much ensure immunity from drinking as intensive work with other alcoholics. It works when other activities fail. Step 12, okay, is going to lay the foundation for this. Now, I'm going to talk about sponsorship. But the 12th step there's only one requirement for the 12th step and to apply it to my life. Does anybody know what that requirement is? It's that I have applied the first 11. Okay? So at this point, my spirit is awakened, and I now take that awakened spirit and I put it into service for others. You remember when the book said selfishness, self-centeredness, that we believe is the root of our problem and of our trouble. Well, if selfishness and self-centeredness is the root of the problem, it don't take a PhD to figure out that unselfishness has to be the root of the solution. Okay? So, I love the way my sponsor, Bob, says it. This is the only place in the world where you come in the door a big shot and work your way up to servant. the only place in the world that happens, right? Servant is the highest level or distinction that one can achieve in this fellowship. It says our true purpose is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and the people about us. Do you note that that statement doesn't mention me? Doesn't mention me. I was at a meeting recently at home, and the statement was made, why me? Why me? I don't know why. Why me? Why not Joe who died? Why me? I know why me. I know why me. I know why I've been blessed. I've been blessed so that I can be a blessing to others. That it's not about me, that it was never about me. And until I understand that, I'm going to spend my time chasing my tail in self-will in here and continue to live in confusion and be a creator of confusion rather than harmony. It's not about me. It's about serving God and serving you. And so I get prepared for that work. Sponsorship, as we know it, and I love it because Bill really laid the foundation in his talk earlier for this. No, sponsorship as we know it today was really, it was Clarence Snyder in Cleveland who really developed the sponsorship ethic. Let's take a look back as to what was going on prior to that. My sponsor's sponsor was a man named Ted R., who was a Russian vodka drinker, who got sober in 1941. His sponsor was Bob Smith in Akron, who's co-founder of AA. So my sponsor was that. So I was given Alcoholics Anonymous in a very clear, simple way, directly out of that line. And so in those early days, they put a man in the hospital. He was put in the hospital by a member of AA. Took him to the hospital, right? While he's in there, he receives a series of visitors, right? And these visitors are your early members. And they come in most of the time, two at a time. And they would sit with him, and they would do what? They would share their story, right? Really, the drunk-along portion is what they shared, right? Because you remember Bill's discussion after he talked to Lois, he talked to Dr. Silkworth. And he said to Dr. Silkworth, you know, I talked to Lois, and I just don't seem to be able to help anybody. Why is that? Evie could help me. How come I can't help nobody? Dr. Silkworth said, you know, I've been watching you in here, Wilson, talking to these guys in the hospital. And he says, you're preaching. You're preaching. He says, you're coming in here talking about this spiritual experience, a light in the room, wind blowing through. Everybody thinks you're nuts. Everybody thinks you're nuts. They want some of what you've been drinking. Right? He says, so I got a suggestion for you. Follow me with this because all this is coming back to sponsorship. He said, why don't you talk drunk to a drunk? Why don't you talk about the thinking? Why don't you talk about the wasted opportunities, the heartache, all the things that have come? Establish that identification, that commonality, that common ground. We call it sinking the hook. I was in detox. Man came to see me. His name was Dave. Dave was a biker. He was about this tall. He was covered with tattoos. He had a leather vest on with patches all over it. I got nothing in common with this guy. I'm in detox. Guy comes in, he sits by my bed, he looks at me, he goes, hi, I'm Dave, I'm an alcoholic. And I said, good for you, Dave. Right? Now, my entire life, people have been talking to me about my drinking. Parents, coaches, counselors, professors, later on, lawyers, judges. Right? Bosses, the significant women in my life. And it's always been this. You ought to be ashamed of yourself. Look at what you're doing to your life. Look what you're killing your mother. You're over and over and over, right? And as soon as that starts, what do I do? Whoosh, wall goes up, baby. You can talk all day, but I just turned you off. Just turned you off, right? This guy, Dave, did something that no one had been able to do, not even the closest people in my life, the people who gave me, like the women I live with, no one had been able to do. Dave came in and did not talk to me about my drinking. He talked to me about his. And in 20 minutes, he took me from here to here. Right? Right. And we're going to talk more about that. And when Dave left that room, because Dave had identified himself as an alcoholic. And I said it last night. You know what alcoholism was. The disease concept of alcoholism was not taught at Miami University or Sandusky High School. I don't know nothing about this. I knew this from that simple talk from that guy in that detox room. When he walked out the door, I knew this. Whatever bit him, bit me. Now, he called himself alcoholic. I don't really understand that. But if that's what the case is, pretty good chance. That's what I am, too. I got it. So Bill comes to Akron, does this very same. What I'm telling you is, if you read this book, this book is the original sponsor. The Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous grew out of this book. This book did not grow out of this fellowship. And this book is laid out in a particular way. And we're going to personalize this in a little bit. But it's laid out in a particular way. First, it talks about the problem. Ain't that what Silkworth told Bill to go do? Go talk drunk to a drunk, right? And that's what it does in the beginning. Doctor's opinion. Bill's story. There is a solution. More about alcoholism. Talks drunk to a drunk. Because I'm in Topeka, Kansas. I'm not in Akron. I'm not in Cleveland. And I ain't in New York. The year is 1939. I get this thing. I do not have the benefit of contact with anybody in AA. I have no sponsor. I have no group. I have no support group. I have nothing. But I got a book. And not only does this book tell me how to obtain sobriety, stay sober, but also how to create the fellowship that I crave. This is the original sponsor. I get more sponsorship. What do I do with my... The answers are in the book. There is nothing that I've ever been asked by a sponsee or any other AA member concerning sponsorship that the answer has not been in this book. Not one single question. Not one. Never been asked one. So Alcoholics Anonymous, from 1939 and the publication of the first edition of this book, and 1955, 16 years later, and the publication of our second edition, went from less than 100 members to over 150,000 in that six-year period. Get it? So this thing, this sponsorship thing, we get back to the early days. You got a guy in a hospital, you got a bunch of guys that come in, they talk to him, they establish identification. They get the guy doing this, right? Then Dr. Bob would come in. Because the next thing the book does, after it talks about the problem, it tells us what the solution is, doesn't it? Tells us what the answer is, right? We have the chapter, We Agnostic. It tells us what the answer is. That we've got to find a power greater than ourselves, a God of our understanding that works for us, right? Tells us what the answer is. So then Dr. Bob will come in. You've heard all these guys talk to you. What do you think, young fella? And the guy go, oh, man. Yeah. I'm like them. And then Doc would say, do you believe in God? Where you at with that? And usually, you know how we are. Well, I kind of, doctor, I asked you that. Do you or don't you? Do you believe there is one? Well, you know, yeah. Right. Okay, then, why don't we ask him for some help? And they would pray right then. Right. Then, right, it's time for the guy to get out of the hospital. Now, already, he's still in the hospital. He's been visited by all these guys. When he comes out of the hospital, he's going to be taken to his first meeting. Now, already, they've designated a guy to help him. They didn't call him a sponsor at that time. I told you, that came from Snyder a little bit late. Right? But they got a guy to help him. They take him to the meeting. That's going to be his home group. Okay? So when this guy goes to his first meeting, he's already got identification, right? He's already taken that first step. He has a sponsor, and he has a group. This is at his first meeting. All of those things are in place. I'm moving towards something here, because I talked about that package last night. And we talked about how those people in here that I watched when I was new, those were the things that they had that were staying sober and who seemed to be happy and who seemed to be doing well in here. Right? This guy had all that at his first meeting. His first meeting. Okay? What was the result of that? What did that actually look like? Okay? I'm going to tell you right here. This is what it looked like. Of alcoholics who came to AA and really tried, and let's say, and really tried, not just sat here, but really, I'd try, right? 50% got sober at once, 25% sobered up after some relapses because they wasn't willing to do certain things. Remember, Dr. Bob wouldn't make amends. He drank again, didn't he? But after a little bit, so we're looking at 75% of the people who came here right off the top. Then it goes on to say, and among the remainder, those who stayed on with AA showed improvement. Other thousands came to a few meetings, said, oh, no, this ain't for me yet. Went back out, took some more beating, right? Came back, and it said two out of three of them began to return as time passed. So I can see clearly here, as a sponsor, what we need to get in place. And I'm not going to talk about the home group right now, but I'm going to say this. When a man comes into my home group, is he offered those things? Or do we shake his hand and say, good to see you, buddy? And then do I turn back to Bill and say, did you see the Hawks last night? Can you believe what happened? Right? What are we doing? Because that's what a man had, and those are the results of it. Snyder comes along, first guy sober in Cleveland, and a series of articles comes out in the Cleveland Plain Dealer about Raleigh Helmsley, who was a catcher for the Cleveland Indians, who got sober. So they do this series. Raleigh Helmsley was a trip. I have a CD of him speaking at a meeting in Washington, D.C. in 1968, and this guy was a riot. And the Cleveland, all the news, you know, in those days, the reporters followed the teams. They traveled with the teams, mostly by train. And all they did in order to have good copy and good stories, let's follow Raleigh. Because Raleigh got into something every night. Fighting and brawling downtown, in jail, the team bails him out. Raleigh was a tornado on the Cleveland Indians. All of a sudden, Raleigh's coming back to the hotel, going to bed and going to the, and they like, what happened to you, dude? And he told them. They had taken him down to Akron. They told him, there's a doctor in Akron who fixes drunks. And unless you go and do what he tells you to do, we're done with you. That's what the Cleveland Indians told him. And Raleigh went to Akron, and Raleigh got sober. So when these articles come out, there's an explosion in Cleveland. Explosion of members. And at that time, there were 12. They had 12 guys when these articles hit. Hundreds of letters began to pour in. So They started to sponsor people. They'd get movie theaters. They'd have people like this. And they took people because there wasn't enough of them to handle it. But after they did that, when the next wave came, now, okay, Kent just shows up. Kent's an auto worker, okay? Bill is already sober. He's a steel worker. We got a lot in common. We're union men. We work every day. Bill's going to work with Kent. He's going to sponsor Kent in his. That's how it started. That's where that term came from. So sponsorship as we know it today began then. Or at least they called it that. When I was new, I heard, I was laughing when Bill said it, because you don't hardly hear that no more. The man I was will drink again, right? How do I know that? Experience. He always did, didn't he? Nothing changes if nothing changes. I heard, this was another one they used to say, you don't hear it much anymore. If you ain't got a sponsor, you ain't planning on staying. And I heard that very clearly when I came in here, right? I love how Bill said that the sponsorship he had was always exactly what he needed. Because my first sponsor was a man named Bill Finley. And Bill was much like those old guys. We did a tree one time of guys that he had sponsored and worked with over the years. Charlie P. did it, and when we got to 2,000 names, we just quit. It was just too many people. He's a man who gave his whole life to this. Ran over and killed two people. Well, he was in a head-on collision in 1956. Killed two people. Went to the penitentiary for that. And he came out of there in 1960, and that's when it started. And Bill took me through the steps out of the book. I had him and Kenny Bombalicki. Kenny's still alive, still sober, still. He's got new guys all behind him. And I swear, everybody on the west side of Cleveland with over 25 years, Kenny sponsors him. He's an amazing human being. And so we go through the steps out of the book. My primary function is to get the tools in the guy's hands, right? And so we do that. Bill was a hollerer. Is that a word? Bill hollered some, right? I'll never forget. I had went to speak at a group in Elyria, Ohio. I was sober less than a year. It's called the hot lunch meeting, and I was working midnight, so I spoke at, it was a noon group, and afterward, Bill founded a place called the Compass House, and Bill, sitting down here, was out there at a Compass House function. We had him out 20 years ago. And I went to the Compass House because in Ohio, we have comments after speakers. Not compliments, comments. Right? It's an old Oxford group thing. See, our meetings came from the Oxford group. So our meetings looked like Oxford group meetings. What they called it in the Oxford group was witnessing from the floor. The speaker would speak, people would get up and share their experience that paralleled that of the speaker. And it's much that way today. And the compliments were wonderful. I was feeling pretty good about myself that day. Well, I walked into Compass House. He took one look at my face, and he knew immediately. And he took me in his office and took the paint off the walls. And he told me, you don't even know what you're doing yet. Just follow the directions I'm giving you. Go to your home group, make coffee, mop the floor after the meeting. That's what he told me, you know, and a lot of other things. I told his wife one day, I called him one day and he wasn't home. His wife, Carol, was in Al-Anon now over 50 years. I told Carol, I said, Bill don't like me. And she said, oh, baby, why would you say that? I said, Carol, he hollers at me all the time. And she said, Ken, if he don't like you, he don't holler at you. Because he hollers at you is because he loves you. I went to the meeting the next night and told everybody, I'm Bill's favorite. Craig was a guy from New Orleans. He had one of them handlebar mustaches. Bill Soap sponsored him. Craig died 40 years sober. God, these guys were great. These was his sponsors. I was the baby. Craig took his toothpick out of his mouth and said, thank God you took the pressure off the rest of us. And so he took me through the steps out of the book. And as we went through the book, he would tell me how the information in the book that we were covering, how it paralleled in his life, how that played out in his life. He brought it to life for me in flesh and bone. And then he would say, now, did that happen to you? I learned from Bill that this has to be internalized. It's not an intellectual thing that we memorize what's in here and we can go to meetings and spout it. It's got to go to here. Did you do that? In the doctor's opinion, when it said that the phenomenon of craving will explain many things for which we cannot otherwise account, he started telling me about stuff. And then I'm like, man, my mother and them wanted me to come and move the furniture with my dad one day so they could, the carpet cleaners could come. And I stopped after work and had a beer and I didn't show up. And see, that my life is littered with that stuff. And I can't, when I finally, they put me on the carpet and say, how could you? Where were you? I ain't got an answer. Can anybody relate to that? I ain't got an answer because I don't know what's wrong with me. So when I learned that, it explained many things for which I could not otherwise account. I always had it. When they put me on the carpet, I had an answer, though. You know, my answers always involved helping others. Anybody else like that? Yeah. My mother would go, where were you? And I would say, well, Sam's mother's in the hospital. I was up there with him. And we prayed together. My mother said, you're somewhere drunk. Get out of here. Right? So we go through the steps. And I'm about 6 months sober. I start speaking at meetings. And I go to a meeting, to speak at a meeting in Lorain one night. It was a big meeting. It was in a treatment center, the old Lakeland Institute, the ski lodge. And I'm in there speaking at this meeting, and a guy comes up to me in detox pajamas. He's got a Hispanic guy. He's got a ponytail all the way down his back, and his hair is gray. He's got tattoos all over him. I've spent a lot of time in jail. I know what those tattoos look like, what they mean. They weren't nice. You know how people have love and hate tattooed on their knuckles? He had hate tattooed on both of his. He walks up to me after the meeting, and he says to me, I live in the same town you do. You are going to be my sponsor. I thought to myself, oh, no, I'm not. Right? So the next day I told my sponsor, I said, this guy asked me to sponsor. He said, well, what'd you tell him? I said, I didn't tell him nothing. He said, why didn't you tell him? Yeah, I said, well, Bill, I don't have a year. I was holding that in my back pocket. You know how that is. You can't do that until you have a year in here, right? And Bill said, are you applying the steps to your life a day at a time to the best of your ability? I said, yes, sir, I am. He said, then what right do you have not to share that with somebody else who asks you for help? He said, who said you're going to live to get a year? I said to him, how come every time I ask you a question, I have to die at the end of the answer? He's always saying that. When they wanted me to speak at a meeting, I told them no. Because I was scared, of course. All of this is fear. You understand that? I'm afraid to sponsor this guy because I don't want to kill him, right? I'm afraid to speak at a meeting because I don't want to stand up in front of 200 people and tell my business, right? They asked me to speak at a meeting. I refused. And, you know, there's a lot of snitches in AA. And they went and they told him, they said, your pigeon has refused to speak at Wednesday Night Industrial. Boy, I got a phone call. He said, I heard you refused to speak at Wednesday Night Industrial. I said, yes, I did. He said, why? I said, I ain't got a year. He said, who said you're going to live to get a year? He said, maybe something that you'll say will help somebody and a family will get better. You selfish. And then a lot of cursing. So I spoke at the meeting, right? So I have a sponsee. And his name's Carlos. And Carlos was a very violent man. He had just got out of prison. He had been in prison in Texas for 18 years. He had taken a knife and gone into a bar and done some very bad things to a whole bunch of people. And he had been released to the custody of his daughter in Ohio. He was literally banned from the state of Texas. So Carlos, I got Carlos. So I'm taking Carlos to meetings with me, right? And And we get into the steps, and we get him in the book. And he's coming to my house, right, and we're sitting at the table, and we're doing a deal, right, till we get to the fourth step. Stop. I told Bill, I said, he won't do no more. Bill said, shh. Bill said, just keep loving him. Just keep loving him. I said, don't you fire people? He said, did you hire him? He said, you're going to have to learn something, son. We sponsor people in here. This is not a cookie cutter deal. Everybody who comes to you will not come to you in the same place. You will meet them where they are, and you will never close the door on the opportunity to be helpful to them. Read the book. What does it say in the book? If somebody says they want to try another way, tell them you wish them well. You know, you only want to be helpful, and I'm here for you anytime. You don't tell them, you're going to get drunk. No. My only purpose here is to be helpful. And I learned that. Carlos stayed like that for 3 years. Came to meetings regularly, and I watched him get angrier and angrier and angrier. And I'm like, it's coming. All right? It's coming. Finally, one morning after the morning meeting, he walked up to me and he said, if I don't do this, he said, I'm going to drink or I'm going to just explode. And I said to him, and I don't know where this came from, it is amazing how God will when it comes to working with other people, how God will just enter the conversation. Because I said to him, would it be helpful to you if I came over your house and sat in the living room while you sit in the dining room and write it and I'm right there? Because I knew there was going to be some ugly things in this man's inventory. And he looked at me and he said, would you do that? And I said, absolutely. And Carlos wrote his inventory. He's a truck driver in North Carolina today. He's sober 23 years. I didn't kill him. I got a guy not long after that, Big Al. And Big Al was a guy who had been in every treatment center from Toledo to Tokyo. He'd been in the military. This guy had been around this program, never got nothing. I knew his family. I did not know him personally. And he asked me to work with him. Big Al was a wonderful guy. He lit rooms up. He's dead now. And because he didn't stay with us. But Al was new. And here again, we're running to meetings and, you know. And I was in my crusading. Early, when you start sponsoring people and AA lights you up and you are convinced you got the answer for everybody, I become the AA crusader. Wait a minute. Now, I know there's no cross-talking in this meeting, but that's wrong. Right? You know what I'm talking about, right? Bill said something to me. He said, don't you ever do that again. He said, the things that you've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous that are tools that are used to assist other people, they're not weapons that you use to attack them. So I got Al. I'm living at my mother in them house. In early sobriety, I had to move back there. I had been banned from there, but I had to move back there because when I came into this program, I was living in a spot. I don't need to tell y'all no more, do I? Can't stay sober in a spot. So I'm back in my mother-in-law's house, and I'm on the phone with Al, and I am reading him the Riot Act, Jack. And you're going to do this, and you're going to do that. I'm not going to talk to you about it no more. Boom, hang up the phone. Sponsor at work. My mother, who had never been to an AA meeting in her life, was sitting there in her chair. My mother had bone cancer at that time. She was dying. My mother looked at me and she said, you know, I know his mom. You know, he's had a really, really tough time. And I know he really doesn't feel good about himself. Do you think talking to him like that is helpful to him? This is from somebody that's not even in here. This book talks about patience, tolerance, understanding, love, and kindness. It says those are the watchwords. And here I am yelling at a guy who beats himself up on a daily basis. And I'm supposed to be helping him. And I stopped that. I stopped it. And Elgar, you know, he stayed sober about 6 years and then he met this girl and, you know, put that in front of what he needed to do. And Al died, he died last year. He never, after them 6 years, he never came back. He never came back. And I ran into him like 4 or 5 years ago out in the mall parking lot at home. And there was a lady in the car with him that he introduced to me as his wife. And he looked at her and he said, "This is the man who sponsored me in AA." And we didn't talk about it no more, right? And Al, eventually, he died last year. By the time I'm 2 or 3 years sober, I'm sponsoring half my town. You guys know how that works, don't you? When you got like 2 or 3 years, you got like 50 sponsees, right? Does anybody really understand why that is? You know why guys with 2 or 3 years sponsor half the town? You know why newcomers love guys with 2 or 3 years? Because when you got 2 or 3 years, you're still crazy. Right? New guys love that, right? You're still crazy. Right? So you got all these guys. Man, we used to go to meetings. We used to go to the Harbortown breakfast meetings about 25 minutes away in an ice storm. We take our newest guy, because he'd been making all the beer and dope runs in the street, right? He just got sober. He used to drive it in them conditions, right? Because when you living in the life, the weather is not an issue, right? So we take our newest guy, put him behind the wheel, and off we go, right? That's how we used to do. God, we had so much fun. We go down to Akron. We go to Dr. Bob's house. Oh, God, we had so much fun. We go to the King School group. That's group one, right? We go to Cleveland to the Borton group. That's the longest continuous AA meeting on earth. We go to all these places, and we hang out with all these old guys. We had a heck of a time. So I got all these guys, right, and I work with a lot of people. I got married. I was about 3 years sober, and I continue to do what I do. My ex-wife was sober longer than me. She still is sober longer than me. And I just kept plugging away. But of course, my life got busy. First daughter was born. I went back to school and got an advanced degree. I went from the union. I went into management at Ford. I started to rise really quickly in the company. But I stayed consistent with what I do here. Even when I was in the MBA program, I changed home groups, right? Because I had to have money. We went to class Monday through Thursday, so I moved to a Friday group. I will say this. Out of all the stuff that's happened in my life since I've been here, and it's a lot, I thank you, God, I've never been inconsistent with what I do here. I've never had a period where, you know, like for 2 years, I didn't really go to, I'm not that kind. I came in here, went to 250 meetings in 3 months and was going to get drunk. I am not the kind, because you hear people that stand behind podiums talking about not working the step for 10 or 11 years and going crazy in the family, getting divorced, sober and all that. I can't do that. I'm not that type. If I don't do this, I'm going to drink. And it ain't going to take that long. If you can stay sober like that, and a lot of people can, people are different. God bless. I'm not one of them. 3 months, and I'm going to 3 meetings a day, and I'm going to get drunk. Because that ain't enough for me. But life starts happening, and I would call my sponsor, and I'd say, "Bill, I'd like to read you my list of grievances for the day." And I would tell him, how people had not treated me properly and hadn't loved me right and things hadn't gone the way that they should. And he would listen quietly. And then when I would get done, this is what he would say. "Who you helping?" I'd say, "I don't think you're listening. Let me read that list again." So I'd read through it again. And he would say, "Who are you helping?" Click. And when Mr. Finley hung the phone up on you, I learned very early, you do not call him back. He's done talking. Who are you helping? Because everything that I was talking about was directly a result of selfishness, self-centeredness, and self-centered fear. And the antidote to that is not intellectual. It is spiritual. It is a spiritual issue. And a spiritual issue demands a spiritual solution, not an intellectual solution, not a relationship solution, not a financial solution. A spiritual problem demands a spiritual solution, and that's why that's what works. Sponsorship is God's will active for an alcoholic like me. It's God's will active. It ain't theory. It ain't, oh, yeah, I know that. No. Sitting down at that table is where Alcoholics Anonymous takes place in my life. I get on airplanes. I do this 30, 35 weekends a year around the world. I'm gone a lot. And it's nice. It's great. Right? I enjoy every minute of it. Right? I want to do what God wants me to do. If that's what God wants me to do, that's what I do. If God wants me to mop the gym floor at my home group, that's what I do. Don't matter to me. I just want to serve. I've taken enough. I just want to serve. So this is what I'm asked to do, so I do it. But if you want to know what Alcoholics Anonymous is in my life, it's the same thing I did with Bill Finley in 1992. We sit down at the table and we crack that book. And I have the privilege of watching the light come back in somebody's eyes. I believe that the first 11 steps of this program will give you 10% of what this has to offer. I believe that the 12th step will give you the other 90. That is my experience. Bill said, if an alcoholic failed to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice with others, he could not survive the certain trials and low spots ahead. If he did not work, he would surely drink again, and if he drank, he would surely die. Tells me right there, if I am not, what does it say? In order to be vital, faith must be accompanied by self-sacrifice and unselfish constructive action. And here we say, if you want to keep it, you got to give it away. For me to come in here and to think of how many people, because we talk about sponsorship, right? And that person that we work with directly or sponsees who works with us directly. But how about those men at my home group? John says to me one day, he said, Kent, I want you to come over to Rick. Rick Hammond was a guy he sponsored. All these guys are dead now. He said, I want you to come over to Rick Sunday at 1 o'clock. I never questioned John. I said, okay, I'll be over there. So I show up and there's all these cars out there, right? And I rang the doorbell and I walked into Rick's living room. And all of the old sobriety in my area and all the little towns surrounding it, all the people from the 40s and the 50s, they were all in one room. You know what I thought to myself? Aha, I knew it. This is the real AA, right? That what they doing with us is not right, right? And of course, that wasn't true. And I came in and sat down, and what those people were doing was, it wasn't an AA meeting. These people were friends. And they read a book. It's called The Greatest Thing in the World. It's by Henry Drummond. And it's about 1 Corinthians 13 and the elements of love, patience and kindness. And each week they would discuss an element of love, and then they would apply it the next week in their morning meditation, and then they would throughout the week see how that played out, right? And then they would come back and they would share. It was the most incredible thing. These were people who were interested in the spiritual way of life. You remember when it talked about that in the big book, that there's a gathering one night of people interested in the spiritual way of life? It was an incredible thing. Afterward, I said to John, I said, the youngest sobriety in that room is 38 years. I said, I got 18 months. Why did you ask me to come here? And he turned around and he looked at me and he said, because you belong here. And he walked away. And I was with those people every Sunday and I watched them die one by one. And I want to come in here and watch my life get better. And turn and walk away from here and say, I got mine. God, I hope you get yours. That's a slap in the face to everybody who helped me. That is a slap in the face. Why do I do it? A lot of reasons. Dr. Bob had four. And if you read The Doctor's Nightmare, on the very last page on 181, this is what the doctor says. I spend a great deal of time passing on. That's what it says up here, doesn't it? Passing on what I learned to others who want and need it badly. I do it for four reasons. One, a sense of duty. I do it because it's the right thing to do, isn't it? Number two, it is a pleasure. And you can't experience that until you do it. I'm sorry, but I can't explain to you how that is. What, remember when I said you get to watch the light come into somebody's eyes? I had a sponsee, Reggie. Another guy who spent 20 years in the penitentiary. Out there where I live, and it started when I was a year sober, if somebody came into an AA meeting and said something that scared everybody, they give them my number. Call this guy. He specializes in guys like you, just like they told me about my sponsor, right? So I was the North Central Ohio Institutional Committee Chairman for 10 years. And I did the county jail meeting at home, 10 years, every Monday night. Reggie would be in the county jail for like a year. This would be like, he would go there, and then they send him to penitentiary, then back to the county, right? I mean, that was his life. And he would sit next to me at every meeting, right next to me, and just stare straight ahead. And I'm like, dude, ain't, you know, he never said nothing, just sat there. And he'd get out of jail. And Reggie was the kind of drunk that when he run out of money, he wouldn't, like, write a bad check or something like that. Reggie would get a shotgun and go to the carryout. That was the kind of drunk Reggie was. That's how Reggie kept going to penitentiary. So he got out of prison. And I got a phone call one day at the house. Reggie had been in prison so long. You know how people become institutionalized? Reggie was stuck in the 70s. Now, this was sometime in the late 90s, I guess, when he got sober. But he was stuck in the 70s. Still had a big afro, platform shoes, right? Reggie stepped out the penitentiary, seen a cell phone, and almost lost his mind. And he calls me up and he talked like he was in the 70s. And he said, Coleman, this here is Reginald A. Alexander. And I've been giving this thing some thought. And I think I might like to try this AA thing. I said, really? I said, okay. I said, I'll come get you. We'll go to meeting tonight. Right? So I go get Reggie. We go to meeting. And I start to take Reggie through the book. Reggie had three daughters. The youngest one was 16 at that time. The other two were grown. And they would not spit on him if he were on fire. They hated the sight of him. When we got to step 9, I said, I want you to make your direct. We make amends with no expectation of the reaction of the other people. Make the amends. He came back and his heart was broke. You do it without expectation, but it still hurts, don't it? Because what they told him was, You ruined our lives. You ruined our mother's life. She had to work her fingers to the bone while you sat in the penitentiary. What we want from you is to never see you again. Leave us alone. I told him, I said, it's okay, baby. Say, you just be here. You just be here. So Reggie stays sober 2 years. They watch. So they start having a little dialogue, right? It usually went like this. We need some money, right? Because Reggie went to college. He was smoking weed in the bathroom at his house, right? All this climbing out the window, you know, and going out at night, you know. He called me up. He said, Coleman, she got to go. I said, oh, no, no, no. I said, it's your turn. It's your turn. She raised them girls while you sat in the penitentiary. I don't want to hear it. Reggie is sober 5 years. I get a call from his oldest daughter. She said, we're going to have a party for Papa. Would you come? It's a surprise party. I said, absolutely. I show up over there. The three daughters have shirts on with his picture like this. And it says, we love our Papa. I was there for that. 2 years ago, I went to speak at a thing in Pennsylvania called the Harvest of Hope. I drove over there. It's like 3 hours. Got home about 2 o'clock in the morning. My phone, Reggie, he remarried, and him and his new wife had a little girl. So he got these three grown daughters, and he got this itty-bitty baby. And he's working, and his life is flourishing. He was a power in the rooms of AA. Sponsored guys, was in the prisons. They let him come in and talk. He was everywhere. Everybody loved him. Just a great guy. And I came home and I got a call and there's a woman sobbing hysterically. I said, I can't understand you. You have to speak slower. She slowed down. She said, Kent, this is Tracy. That was Reggie's wife. She said, Reggie got on his knees, said his prayers tonight, had a heart attack and died. On his knees. He was 11 years sober. It is a pleasure. I see her and I see his daughter, his youngest daughter. Just saw him not too long ago. She looked just like him. His daughters came to me at his funeral and they asked me to speak at his funeral. And they said, Kent, thank you for giving, helping us get our Papa. This stuff goes beyond words. And if you don't do it, you can never know. It is a pleasure. Because in doing so, I am paying my debt to the man who took time to pass it on to me. I think about Bill. He died, he had Parkinson's. The last time he got on an airplane to go speak at AA was the big meeting in Hawaii. And by that time, like, he had to have a wheelchair at the airport, you know, all that. It is a pleasure. Because in doing so, I am paying my debt to the man who took time to pass it on to me. I think about Bill. He died, he had Parkinson's. The last time he got on an airplane to go speak at AA was the big meeting in Hawaii. And by that time, like, he had to have a wheelchair at the airport, you know, all that. When he came back from Hawaii, he told me, he said, Kent, the only reason I took that was so that my wife could see Hawaii. He said, I'm not going to go anymore. He said, you go. Go as much as you can. He said, I'm not going anymore. He spoke at local meetings to this day, and I've heard... And I'm biased. I've heard the great speakers in AA. Still the best talk I've ever heard in AA. When I came in and he was in his prime, I'm telling you, he had fire in his belly and he had lightning coming out of his eyes, and I ain't joking you. I've never seen a man who loved AA as much as he did. By himself, he started the central office in Lorain County and 50 meetings in that county, all of which are still running today. He was an unbelievable human being. And I think about Bill and I think about the time. I was his pet. He told me one time, he said, I'm gonna do a big book weekend in Ohio. I ain't done one in a long time. Find me a place. Click. Find you. I don't know no place. I was 3 years sober. I found him a place. I said, how about Beulah Beach? He said, beautiful. He said, let's go over there. We went over there. We did the contract, the food, the room rate, the whole nine yards. We get in the car. He looks at me. He says, did you see how I did that? I said, yes, sir. He said, okay, now I want you to make a flyer. Don't put my phone number on it. Put yours. Right? So I make a flyer. Big book weekend. Bill F. Lorraine, Ohio. Blah, blah, blah. Send the flyer out. We had 200 slots. It sold out in 3 weeks. We had people coming from New York, West Virginia, all of that. Everybody loved them. Right? I said, well, Bill, it's sold out. He said, excellent. He said, get yourself a registration committee. You're going to need one. Click. So I called some girls in Cleveland that I knew were coming. I said, have you guys ever done anything like that? They said, yeah, we know how to do that. We got you. Right now, I got a registration committee. So we show up. It's Friday night. Whole place is packed. Everybody's there. Everybody's checked in. Everybody's had their dinner. We're sitting in the cabin, me and my wife, him and his. He says, everything ready? I said, yes, sir, it is. He looked at me. He said, good. You'll begin with the doctor's opinion. I said, begin what? He says, you will begin presenting tonight with the doctor's opinion. I said, I'm not doing... I said, these people came from other states. You'll begin with the doctor's opinion. So I began with the doctor's opinion. When I came back from Vegas, he was in hospice, and I went to see him. Nobody there but me and him. He could barely talk. But he turned his head and he looked at me. I'm sitting by his bed and he got this smile on his face. And he goes, you remember the first time I had you do book in public? Yeah, I remember, Bill. I remember. I'm still doing it, man. Still doing it. Because every time I do it, I take out a little more insurance for myself against a possible slip. People ask me, Ken, how many people do you sponsor that are sober? I say, I don't know, but I'm batting 1,000. I ain't drank yet. Bill Wilson, do you remember sober a year and a half? During which time he said I could find little work. Resentment and self-pity nearly drove me to drink, right? But I soon discovered that work with another alcoholic would save the day. Would save the day. Who are you helping? Because life is coming. When the book talks about those certain trials and low spots ahead, it ain't talking about potential trials and low spots ahead. It said certain trials and low spots ahead. It's coming. Buckle up. It's coming. You're going to get sick. Other people you love are going to get sick. People are going to die. Divorces is coming. Loss of jobs is coming. We are not immune to life. I can stand here today and tell you this. I've done this stuff to the best of my ability. I never done it perfect. Yes, there's days you could follow me around and you never know I've been in one of these meetings. I'm human, right? But progressively, because recovery is progressive, they get further apart. But through all the things I've been through, I can stand here today in all honesty and tell you I have never once had a thought of taking a drink since I started working the steps with my sponsor. And I am a chronic alcoholic. Y'all heard my business last night. I don't have the power not to. I have not had a thought of taking a drink. I've had a lot of other kind of thoughts, but I've not thought of taking a drink. And that is the miracle. Bill said the series of miracles, it continues with me every day. Who you helping? Who you helping? If you're new and you haven't been through the steps yet because you can't transmit what you haven't got, it's okay. If you can't carry the message to the alcoholic, you got a car, you can carry the alcoholic to the message. Load your car up and take them. That's what they told me to do. You give what you have. The more you get, the more you give. Give what you got. You got a day, that guy drank this morning, tell him what you did today. The sooner I go from being on the take to being on the give, this thing will start working. I will be living in the solution and not the problem. That's the bottom line here. So sponsorship to me, quite frankly, and Bill used to say it, is the biggest problem we got in AA today, is a lack of it. It's a lack of it. And I get to see a lot of things in AA, and I wholeheartedly agree. I have Bob Darrell as my sponsor now. I was Bill was sick. I was in the middle of a divorce. I'm getting ready to, I don't know what I'm getting ready to do. My life was just 20 years sober. Boom! And I mean, the big house, I live in a gated place. I had all, boom! And I'm driving down the road and I'm talking to Bob Darrell on the phone about something else. We were doing a conference in Akron. And I don't know where it came from. But all of a sudden I said, Bob, I need to change gears here, man. Can I talk to you about something? And he said, yeah, sure, yeah. And I just threw up all over him. And I told him everything that was going on. And he got quiet on the other end. And he said, shh. He says, you're going to be fine. He said, I've been through that twice myself. And he rocked me to sleep. And I asked him to sponsor me that day. Right when I needed it, right then. And I love the sponsor I have today. I talked to him yesterday. And he is, a lot of you know him, he is absolutely relentless in what he gives for others. He's an amazing human being. And he gets on airplanes 50 weeks a year to go do this somewhere in the world. He's an amazing human being. And he's active in his home group. He's there every week, every Monday night. And once again, I've been blessed with another great example of how to do this, not just talk about it. So that's what I got for you on sponsorship. I said it last night. If you don't have one, get one before you leave here this weekend. There's a lot of wonderful people here. Thanks for listening. Time is up. God bless.